The most productive, innovative, creative classrooms are a neurodiverse one. I think I have been talking about this exact topic for probably, I don't know, the last decade. And my amazing guest, Claire Britton, who's joining us today on the Child Charmer podcast, all the way from Perth, well, online, guys, you know, is a director, an OT, occupational therapist, at a beautiful business called Neuro Inclusion. Claire is originally from Melbourne, and we've just found out we're both we're Westies, which, you know, means she's a girl very close to my heart. And she now provides internationally via telehealth. She runs the Neurodivergent OT Instagram account. And if you have not seen the amazing visuals she is putting out there, guys, please head on over and check it out. She's now a busy mum raising two beautiful busy boys and two fur babies, which I'd love to hear more about. She works with a variety of schools and educators on the importance of providing neurodiversity affirming learning. Claire, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited. What do you create all your visuals on? Using
Canva.
Do you? So amazing. Yeah. I love them. And they're just so easy to digest too, I think, which is so important. I have got a copy of your neurodiversity affirming teaching wheel, if that's what you call it, which we are going to unpack a little bit with you about as we go through the conversation. But tell me about your time in education in Broadmeadows.
Yeah, so I used to work at Broadmeadows Special Developmental School, which is actually where my career started. And I then moved into private practice, where I've been more working as a consultant, attending different schools and different types of schools to support in the classroom. But I really think that having OTs in, you know, in the grounds and as part of the staffing is really different to when we have external providers coming in providing support to our teachers and our educators. There's lots of reasons for this, but I think a big one is I know the theory, I know how it looks in my ideal world based off the evidence and the research, but if I don't understand that classroom and the classroom dynamics the way that a teacher does, I might as well be like recommending that they learn a different language. Because even though that other language would be really helpful, say if they went on a holiday over there, it comes from a great place, but it isn't going to land unless I understand the dynamics in the classroom. And the best person that knows everything about their classroom is their teacher. And so developing that relationship between therapist and teacher is really the difference in terms of the progress of the students and the progress of the teacher as well. Because there's no point, like, you know, educators these days have got so much on their plate. And to have an external provider who maybe their first time working with them, maybe they've worked with them a little bit, comes in and makes all these additional recommendations. And it's actually just additional tasks and additional things that teachers have to do without any understanding of the capacity that they have, the other, you know, pressures and the other focus and priority areas of the school. So it can really be challenging, and it can kind of, from a therapy perspective, I do a lot of coaching and mentoring other therapists that provide therapy in schools. And I often do hear, oh, this teacher just refused my recommendation, or this teacher didn't do this thing that would help. And I often have to stop them and say, let's just pause for a second and remember that they have their own way of doing things. They have their own systems in place. And us coming in and providing all these changes and these strategies, there's a reason. They're not saying no to help for no reason. And I think that we need to have that ability to take those perspectives, because collaboration is where the magic happens. But often teachers are so burnt out and so exhausted that they don't quite know where to go to access some of that support. A lot of schools do have, you know, a psychologist they may refer to, whether that be on staff or external, which is great, but often they are also at capacity. So it can be really helpful to be able to identify what person or what therapist is the best for what things.
So
to all the
interesting.
different
You so,
scenarios.
sorry to cut you off there.
Oh,
Claire and I were talking before we hit record about how, 15 years ago, when I was still working in education as well, we had specialists on staff, we had speeches on staff, we had OTs on staff, and those are few and far between now. And yeah, you're right, they were always at capacity because there was lots of kids who were needing that extra support. And one of the other barriers that we face in education as well is that many schools are not open to specialists coming in to the school environment to work with our kids. Some teachers, and we love teachers in this community and on the Child Charmer podcast, but it's disruptive. I mean, I've been a teacher where kids have been pulled out for music lessons or, reading programs and all that sort of, all those sorts of things. And yes, it is disruptive, but if we're playing a long-term game here, we actually see that those things are what kids actually need to help them be able to learn, focus, sustain attention, right? So,
yeah, I think,
yeah.
sorry, I think you've touched on a really beautiful point there, Chrissy, that there's two models of providing therapy supports within an education system. And one of them's called pull out, where we pull the student out and work with them one-on-one in a separate room. And then we come back in and we say, they did really great today. See ya, I might email you with my recommendations, and I expect them to be implemented in the next couple of days. But the other way that we know is now becoming more and more common and is best practice is this push in. So the therapist actually joins the classroom, and they join the classroom to build that understanding of what is going on. What are the dynamics here? I'm here for Brad, but actually Brenda and Josh and James and 12 other students are actually so much more dysregulated. So me providing strategies to Brad is not going to be effective when they've got all these other students that are dysregulated. And in terms of the teacher's priorities, Brad's not being unsafe. He's not disrupting other students. He's not aggressive. There's no behaviors that they're concerned with. So it makes sense that they're not going to pick up on my strategies for Brad. However, if I'm able to provide supports and strategies for some of the other students or make recommendations that are more holistic of the entire classroom, they're a lot more likely to be successful. So the push-in approach, I find, is a lot more inclusive and a lot better in terms of that functional practice. And also the teacher's seeing what I'm doing. And I can trial the strategies in the classroom with the teacher. I can see the teacher looking at me going, what are you doing? And I can stop and I can say, you are the expert of your classroom. I only know the theory and I only know the clinical experience that I've had. If this doesn't suit your classroom, that's great. That's fine. We've got lots and lots of different things they can try. It's not this is the only thing, and if you do not implement this, I'm going to take personal offense to it, and our, relationship is not going to work. So I think that it's a really great thing that you're touching on in terms of traditional therapists and traditional supports often do take kids out of classes, and that's not best practice because
That's not
especially with some of
inclusive,
our
people. That is,
no, that's
let
it.
the kid over there that needs extra support. Ding, ding, ding. Do you know what I mean? It is so important that true inclusion is seamless, right? It shouldn't be obvious which child has the disability or which child is needing the extra support. I love that. And I think that that's a fundamental shift. And if we think about the fact, we're also talking about how NDIS and education just do not work together. They are like separate entities that our kids get funding for OT, yet most of their challenges, like I could say, my little guy is in the classroom, right? And so the support is so needed in the classroom, in the environment where the stress is rising, not out of the classroom, like you said, where the nervous system is more regulated. So I would love to see that happening more. And I think, educating people, teachers who are listening to this podcast about how that actually can look seamless and less disruptive and actually highly effective, maybe more educational settings will be open to it.
Yeah, I love that.
So tell me a little bit about your wheel that you have created.
So I created a bit of a wheel to create a summary for an understanding of what neurodiversity affirming practice is in terms of teachers and educators. So we understand that it is really difficult for teachers to try and mold their classroom, mold the way that they support their students as best practice and as what this new research has come out. And we know that when research does come out, it takes 10 years for it to actually impact practice and impact the actual consumer or the student themselves. So this research is literally coming out as we speak. So it's only been really since 2018 that research has started to come out about this.
No, oh, baby, I was so far ahead of my time.
That's it. Yes, definitely.
The world wasn't ready for me.
Yes, exactly. And unfortunately, for so long, it was seen as alternative or alternative education or alternative teaching. And that kind of created a bit of a confusion around the reliability and validity of this approach. And now we know through research that's not the case at all. But we in order for people to research something, it has to be successful for an extended period of time. So this is not a new approach, like you're saying, Christy. This has been around for ages and ages and ages. But the research to back it is fresh. And so people that have been practicing this way for so long, some are aware and some aren't aware that now we have research to support it. It's not just your own, you know, professional and lived experience that this works for students. There's research to back it, which is really exciting.
And I think a key takeaway there is that a neurodiversity affirming approach works for all kids, not
yes.
just the neurodivergent kids. And I think that's a big shift for a lot of teachers, because I've sat in meetings before where, you know, some teacher or leaders have said, well, we can't just implement that for one child, which shows a real lack of understanding about how a fundamental neurodiversity affirming teacher or educational approach actually benefits all kids. You know, so it's a real mind shift, isn't it? So some of the key underpinnings you've got on your little wheel is experts. Hello, over here. Accommodations, which we're learning so much more about. Regulation tools, not toys. Feedback, giving kids feedback. Collaboration, flexibility, communication, connection, and priorities. Which basically, you know, could be your pedagogical, I hate that word, your core family, your core teaching values. Do you know what I mean? That if you can fundamentally get your head around these couple of key things and embed them into your everyday teaching philosophy, you're already living and breathing in neurodiversity affirming practice, right?
Yes, definitely. And I think that's something that a lot of people are surprised by, how much it already aligns with them. It's not something extra they may have to do. It just gives them the reasoning as to why they do it and the confidence to then say to their leadership team, no, this is how I'm doing it because this is what the research says, rather than, yes, you know, you have experience and you are in leadership and you do support the team your way. But ultimately, it's my classroom. So I can hear you. I can understand. I can add it to my toolbox. But is it really going to be the first tool I use? Maybe not. And that's okay.
So we know for sure that, you know, we've come a long way. Like I said, I've been banging on about this for a decade. And I think because I have predominantly worked in specialist settings and then been able to transfer those skills into a mainstream setting and have the lived experience of seeing how successfully this approach works for all kids. We've still got a long way to go in schools becoming more neurodiversity affirming and moving away from behaviorism. So what advice can we give to the amazing teachers? We sort of just touched on it then, of having the courage to go their own way, even though it may not be leading from the top down.
Yeah, I think it's more to do with knowing your values, knowing what you believe and what you know works, because that is just as valuable, because you're the only person that's in that classroom day in, day out that knows your students the way you do. There's nobody else. No person in leadership, no parent, no therapist. You know your classroom best, and ultimately how you run your classroom is in your control. And so having that awareness and that value of ultimately how you run your classroom is yours. And that is so empowering. And it's something that a lot of teachers find a challenge, because they feel like there's so many people telling them, do this, do that, do this, do that. And they come from a great place, but yeah, it's your power, your room, your class.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I really advocate for and I would love to see as one of my gold standards is a more consistent approach to understanding behavior and behavioral responses, moving right away from more punitive measures like suspensions and, you know, keeping kids in and all those sorts of things that lots of schools are still practicing, which are so outdated and punitive and actually just don't do anything to help the kid be successful. But the research sort of tells us too that if we can get consistency whilst we are in our classroom, like you said, and we are responsible for the relationship building and all the things that happen in that classroom, the research actually also tells us that if we can even have in our teams some more consistency, or in our cohort, say across the grade 3-4 level, if we all were able to work together to come up with a universal language or approach to understanding and supporting behaviors within that community, we see a significant shift and a significant reduction in behavioral incidences, because kids are getting that consistent message across, you know, the staff, which
yeah,
is
so I think that's powerful. Brilliant. And I think it can be as simple as moving away from attention seeking. So every time you feel yourself or someone else commenting on a student being attention seeking, moving that to a connection seeking, and just see how that fits. See how the conversation is different, and having that consistent language of we don't acknowledge attention seeking, because everyone needs attention, and actually attention is rooted in connection. Mm-hmm. So if we come at it from a connection perspective, ultimately that's going to best align us to empathize, be more curious, and be more open to what are some potential ways that we can support this student without the judgment of, you know, what that the connotations actually mean.
So if somebody's listening to this sort of for the first time and they're like, oh yes, this sounds amazing, this is the kind of teacher I want to be, but I'm not really sure where to start. Obviously, we've got our values that we've spoken about, your beautiful wheel that you've created, but what advice would you have for a person or a teacher who was listening to this thinking, okay, how do I crank this up a notch?
There are some really amazing podcasts like this one that are slowly coming out and developing lived experiences where, you know, people like Chrissy and myself, we were the students at these schools and we have lived experience of what would help. And so you should be listening to people who are neurodivergent or identify to be neurodivergent, whether that be self or formally diagnosed, and just hearing what they think would be helpful and what they would have wished for their teachers to be like. This really sets us up to improve things for, you know, the future and the future generations of people, which would be amazing. Also doing the research, you know, going on to reading different books. There's lots of people with lived experiences that are writing literature, writing kids books. One of my favorite books that I love reading kids is Everybody Belongs, because it just creates a starting point and a starting point for conversations around accepting differences and accepting diversity. You know, the word itself, neurodiversity, is accepting everybody who has a nervous system, regardless of what type that is. So if we start with that understanding of what is neurodiversity, that then opens the doors to the conversations of all the different neurotypes within a classroom, and all those types not being better or worse, just different. And that's what brings the innovation and the celebration of the diversity that we have in our classrooms. I'm actually in the process of developing a online demand course that teachers are able to do at their own speed and their own time, and that will break up these principles in terms of more practical strategies and what that looks like on a day-to-day basis. So there's also the amazing Yellow Ladybugs.
Yes.
They are obviously based in Victoria. They've just brought out a book, and they are working with the Department of Vic Education around creating a curriculum for teachers to be able to implement more successfully and seamlessly. So there's things that are happening. There's movement, yes. There's progress.
I've definitely seen movement. Obviously, someone who's, like I said, been working in this space for such a long time, and I'm a huge champion for teachers. And I'm in schools a lot, and I meet so many amazing teachers who are open to learning and they want to consume information. And, they're one of the things I think I realized myself, especially going down the ADHD road with my kids, is just how little it is understood. And it's so complex, right? It's like autism. It is so complex. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we have in classrooms around neurodivergence is that the spectrum is so varied from child to child. And expecting teachers to be across all of the things that all of the kids need is virtually impossible, And some of these teachers are just twisting themselves inside and out trying to meet the needs of these kids. And they really should be celebrated and respected for all of the work, the amazing work that they're doing. But to me also, it neurodiversity affirming practice is fundamentally your core beliefs about valuing differences, right? And I think one of the biggest challenges we have in education is we're bound by a curriculum that expects everybody to achieve at the same level at the same time. And that is not very neurodiversity affirming, is it?
No, I think another big aspect of this, and a way of kind of changing a bit of the conversation and the way that we perceive success in a classroom, is looking at some of these behaviors that students present. And rather than coming at it from a, what have I done wrong? How can I fix this? How can I stop this child from experiencing these really intense emotions? Actually looking at it from the neurodivergent person or student's perspective, which often is, I don't feel safe expressing this really intense emotion anywhere else. And what you're actually doing in your classroom is providing a safe space that they can be vulnerable, that they can explode and erupt with all their emotion to process it. Because I don't know about you, but I currently don't feel comfortable crying right now because I'm, too busy thinking about how I'm being perceived and I'm too busy, wanting to become across as professional as possible. But maybe, I stubbed my toe. Maybe something else has happened in, personally in my life. And I don't have the avenue to spill it out and to actually process this emotion. And so what we often see in classrooms is when students have such big externalizing behaviors, it's not because the teachers did anything wrong. It's actually because the teachers are doing a really great job providing a safe environment that this student might not actually even have at home. They might not have an environment where they can be their authentic self and explode and know that they're safe and that they're going to be supported in the way that they need. So when we think about it in that way, trying to prevent the meltdowns or prevent the behaviors, we can see why that's not working. Because that means that this child doesn't can't bottle can't, has to bottle it up at home, has to bottle it up in therapy, and now has to bottle up at school. Well, that's ultimately going to make everything everywhere only get worse.
It's going to come out somewhere, isn't it? And I mean, the
That's
challenge we
it.
have around that obviously is safety, that we want kids and teachers to be safe and the students who are experiencing dysregulation to be safe. And I think on that topic, one of the things that I sort of constantly talk to school leaders about is staying the course. We've got to stick with these kids long enough. And when we do that and we allow them to express those emotions in a safe way, or we give them a safe exit strategy, or we create an area where they can go to blow, as I say.
Love
Sometimes you've got to blow to grow is one of my favorite sayings. Or you grow through what you blow through. I think it's that most important understanding that neurodivergent children and adults experience fluctuating emotions on
And
varying
frustrating
scales.
capacity, which is
Absolutely.
really frustrating for neurotypicals because they're like, I know this student did it. They did it on Thursday. Why can't they do it today? And how can I create a program or a curriculum or a class plan based off fluctuating capacity? Because the curriculum says we should be doing more things and ticking more things off in a gradual graded way, but it doesn't align with the capacity of the neurodivergent person, let alone their regulation, their capacity in terms of their cognition. it's too tricky for them. And so we can see how the system is inherently flawed. And so it's not the specific teachers that are having the difficulty. It's so layered. And so trying to pinpoint concerns or challenges to a particular level is problematic in itself too.
So we talk about obviously trying to really move away from using sanctions as as more of a neurodiversity affirming approach. What are the other do's and don'ts that you recommend or that you can sort of think of?
We kind of want to understand that the neurodivergent person has a reason for why they're doing what they're doing. And our job as teachers and educators is providing them an opportunity to problem solve with us, because most of the time they have already probably thought of a solution that works for them. And I don't know what that solution is until I have that conversation. And we know through the work of Dr. Ross Green, who, he has the CPS model, which, is the collaborative proactive solutions model, which really creates that structure and that foundation for this approach, and which is why it aligns so beautifully with neurodiversity affirming, is actually having the conversation with the student when they're regulated. So I'm noticing every time you come in after lunch, you kind of feel like a little bit lost and you're throwing your pencil case around. Can you explain what's happening for you? Because I'm just trying to see what we can do to help you. What? No one's ever had that conversation with this student. And potentially the student's not even aware that they're doing it. They're like, oh, am I? Oh, well, great. You've actually put the idea in their head. So the next time they do it, they're more aware and develop that insight, because a lot of this is collaboration. And I think when we accept that it's collaboration, a lot of the weight from the teachers and a lot of the responsibility that the teachers feel to have all the answers to fix all the problems is alleviated. And therefore, the teacher's more regulated, so the students are more regulated.
And it's giving kids agency and autonomy, isn't it? And actually encouraging them to think about why that particular scenario or that request or directive or whatever it might be is difficult for them. Do you know what I mean? And you're right. Often kids can tell you it's too noisy or I don't want to sit on the floor or whatever it might be, right? And I think that the more we can give kids the autonomy and agency, but also hold that relational safety and boundaries. It's such a fine line. It is
It
so interesting because giving kids agency and autonomy is does not mean giving them free rein. It means giving them, some
is. A
choice
seat at the table.
within,
Just
well,
be
yeah,
involved.
absolutely, but within also the parameters that we set for ourselves as educators because we're, crowd controlling 28 kids. You know what I mean? So
Exactly.
I think one of the other don'ts that is often comes up is about communication from neurodivergent people. Like, oh, I can probably, it's something I've been talking to my kids a lot about recently, and something I've really worked on as an ADHD is my delivery. And we can be quite blunt. We don't fluff, we don't filter, we just say it how it is. It comes out before we've even had time to think about the words, and I still feel like there's a lot of educators out there that get offended by some of the communication styles of neurodivergent kids. And you can talk a little bit more to this as well, but it's more about intent than tone, right?
So we talk a lot about tone policing and getting in those nuanced conversations of, but I thought you meant this. And so rather than coming at it from that perspective, being more curious. I'm just wanting to clarify what you're saying in this moment. So for me, it sounds like this is a really, really stressful issue that's actually making you very scared. Is that how you feel? You don't? Okay. Because we don't sometimes, because that filter isn't there that neurotypicals have, where we've had a thought, we've thought about applying it to the situation, we've thought about our language use, and we're going to calmly tell everyone how we feel in a very controlled sense. Because we don't have those executive functioning, like, impulse control and motor planning, it does just come out. And so often we're having to be reactive in terms of ensuring that communication has been delivered as intended. But just give people the benefit of the doubt. If we're given 5 more seconds of just, do you mind just elaborating a little bit more? Or I don't understand completely what you mean in this particular, like, can you give me an example? And giving that, the opening that door to that level of communication is actually really important. And identifying that, like, this doesn't make sense in my mind. So obviously I'm missing something in the communication. What can we do about it? Can they write it down? Can they send it in an email? Can we talk on the phone about it later? Can we, you know, maybe move to a more private location where they feel like they're not being overheard by all the other students? They're the really simple communication strategies that are really effective. And a lot of the time teachers do it really beautifully and seamlessly. But I'm really aware that that's why they're having success when other teachers aren't, because they don't even know to recommend that as a strategy, because they just do it. Like, oh yeah, I just talked to Brenda in my little office and she opens up a lot more. So maybe I should tell a music teacher that. I guess I should tell the art teacher that. But I didn't know that that was like a strategy thing.
You're right. And I think a lot of teachers are already doing these things. And often, you know, I'll say to my little guy, you came across really angry then, but I don't actually think that's what you meant. Is that right? And he'll be like, oh, yeah, sorry, Mum. No, that's not what I meant, you know. And so it's really important that you do listen actually to the words that the kids are saying rather than the way it is delivered, because, you know, take it from me, it's really, we really are big-hearted, beautiful people, and we don't intentionally go around wanting to hurt people or hurt their feelings, you know. So,
yeah.
Okay, so what are some cost-effective strategies we can use for supporting neurodivergent kids?
Well, obviously just having the conversations is completely free. So having the conversations, opening the doors to bringing in people that have lived experience or have experienced this personally or professionally to come in and talk about, you know, what strategies work for them and what are some best practices. Things like just Googling, listening to podcasts, chatting with other therapists, other people that you do interact with within your network. There's quite a lot of Facebook groups around neurodiversity affirming teaching and around practices. It also can be as simple as just adding visuals. So rather than just talking to people, how can we add more layers of sensory information? So obviously talking is very auditory based. How can I then add a visual? Then I might even add a tactile. I might actually give them their pencil case, and that's a tactile cue. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be more work. It doesn't necessarily have to be a resource that you have to go and purchase and buy. And a lot of the older strategies are like that in terms of, you know, those reward charts. You got to go buy the reward chart, print it out, laminate it, make it all pretty, get some tokens, remember where the tokens are kept. All of that kind of stuff can kind of go out the window. And valuing connection and authenticity in your relationships with your students is where the value is. That's better than any reward chart or behavior chart could ever be.
Absolutely. So I often say to teachers too with ADHD, is if they can't see it, it doesn't exist. Do you know what I mean? And talking, we talk so much as teachers. So much is lost in translation with our kids, with the, especially neurodivergent kids who process information so differently to neurotypical kids. And it's so interesting how we can, I really feel like neurodiversity affirming philosophies are subtle but impactful. Things like, you know, ADHD is call out all the time. They it's setting a goal for them to put their hand up and wait is almost setting them up to fail. So instead of having that expectation, instead of saying put your hand up, let's just do turn and talk to the person next to you. Then no one has to put their hand up. No one has to wait. And so we're actually setting all of those kids up for success rather than expecting them to be able to do a skill that is incredibly difficult for them, right? How subtle is that? I mean, that is so simple, but so impactful and so less disruptive for a teacher having to say, stop calling out, put your hand up, wait your turn. Do you know what I mean? It just reduces so much of that disruption as well. You think the child with ADHD is being disruptive. Think of all the disruptions that it causes when with the teacher drawing attention to it, you know. So subtle. And I think so much of it really comes back to relinquishing control. I feel like teachers feel to have good classroom management, which we kind of don't call it that anymore. We call it classroom behavior support rather than management, because it is about collaborating. It is about coming alongside kids. It is about encouraging them to have autonomy as a learner and as a little human being, whilst trying to do all the curriculum at the same time. But I think when you kind of step back and relinquish some of that control, you actually see the stress go down, which means the behavioural incidences go down, that kids are just happier, they're humming along a bit more positively, and then it's kind of a win-win for everybody. Oh, you and I could talk about this all day, my friend.
Definitely, yes.
We were
Oh.
just saying we really need to book something in Western Australia. So stay tuned for that, people. But tell us, talking about free resources, I mean, how many amazing Instagram pages are there now
So
out
many.
there? And yours is up there as absolutely one of my favorites. I'm so proud of you. It's
Thank
just
you.
every time I see something of yours, I'm like, yes, tick, share. Couldn't agree more. Could have said it myself,
You.
so tell people where they can find your work and follow along all the amazing changes you're inspiring people to create.
So you can follow my business on Facebook at NeuroInclusion. My Instagram is the NeuroDivergentOT, and my website is www.neuroinclusion.com.au. And I provide consultative services and supports and PDs through telehealth from Perth. And yeah, I think they're probably the main channels, but honestly, there's so many people that are trying their absolute best to make this work,
Yes.
and we just need to provide an opportunity for them to talk and have the platform that they need. They want to we want to share you our strategies and our ideas. It's just providing the time and the energy to do so.
And the reality is, it's the only way forward in education.
Yeah.
The rate of children being identified is not slowing down, people. It is only increasing. And that means that we are going to have more and more neurodivergent kids in mainstream education. And that is why we just got to get on board. Quicker the better.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've probably touched on this before, Chrissy. And we know that, like, some people talk about, oh, why is there a sudden increase? And the education system's actually experienced this before with left-handers, because for so long they were like, right-handers, right-handers, right-handers. We need to, punish people for using their left-handers, left hand, sorry. And then the second that they said, okay, you can use left or right, there was a huge increase in left-handers. And everyone was like, oh my goodness. It's an epidemic of left-handers. So we know that that's not the case. That the most of the time, the neurodiversity in the classroom has always been there. It's just our ability to pick up on it, our ability to actually support the students with what they need, and having more of an awareness to it. It's not necessarily that there's more diagnosing or more people that are becoming autistic or becoming diagnosed. They've always been there. It's just they're now actually getting the support that they need.
Yeah, and in our generation, it was probably beaten out of us. Do you know what I mean?
That's it. Yeah,
We were beaten
definitely.
into being submissive, whereas now we're so much more embracing and welcoming of our kids and everything they bring to our world, and it's a real celebration. So, thank you so much for all the work you're doing. We'll keep championing together in this space, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us today. And I love your branding that you're wearing, neuro inclusion people. Go and
Yes,
check it
full
out. Thanks so much, Claire.
Thank you so much, Chrissy.
Well, guys, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining in to the Child Charmer podcast. I hope that by joining this conversation, I've been able to inspire and empower you to go out and continue striving for better educational outcomes for our kids. If you're keen to learn more about the work that I'm doing in education, feel free to take a look at my website, www.chaostocalmconsultancy.com, and who knows, maybe I can come out and spread a little Chrissy magic in your school community. Until then,